10 minutes. No. Okay. My name's Annette and I'm an alcoholic. Okay. I've been asked to be the 10-minute speaker. After that, there'll be a 10-minute break before the main speaker. Okay. Here we go. My name's Annette and I'm an alcoholic. When my sponsor came up and asked me, she said thank you. And I thought she meant thank you for going to the dinner last night, because she asked me to go because she wasn't going to be there. And she goes, no, you're thanking me because you're going to be the 10-minute speaker. And I told her, really? You need to get out of my face right now, you know, because that's, you know, that resentment just came up. That's my first thought, was resentment. But however, you know what? I'm up here because I need to be up here. Because years ago, I said, the best thing I have is lead me where you need me. And sometimes you go places where my higher power puts me, and I don't want to go, but I go. Because I just do it. Because my own thinking got me here. However, God's will keeps me here. Even though sometimes I don't want to, you know, you just keep on coming back. My sobriety date is September 24th of 2000. I started drinking. I was a late bloomer, about 28. I got sober when I was 36. And I'm really grateful. You know, I think back about, you know, you come in here, and I came through a different program, a court system that made me get a sponsor. I didn't like women. My mother didn't raise me. I was raised by my dad. He was single. I never bonded with anybody. I never bonded. And I still have problems bonding with people today. I have a really difficult problem. I have a thing called detachment disorder, where, you know what, you stay here and, you know, I'm okay with you there. You hang on to me 5 seconds, that's enough. You know, I'm done. And so something happened, you know, they told me to get a woman sponsor. I said, okay, so I did it. Before that, I used to like alcoholic men because you were fixable. I thought I could fix you. However, you know, we were in a meeting yesterday morning about, I was really mean to people. My sisters, I would stab them, push them down the stairs, slam their fingers in the doors, because I didn't know how I felt on the inside. But if I looked at you and you were crying, I understood that. You know, so, you know, something happened when I got in the program. You know, I did the court program 18 months. That was simple. Because at that time, I asked people in my family that I needed help. However, my family didn't want me any better because at that time I was under their control. Whatever they said, I did. And something happened, you know, I just kept on coming back and I got a woman sponsor because I wasn't a woman. I didn't have any of those skills that I was taught as a child. Even as an adult, I didn't have any of those skills. And I came here and you women, like, you know what? I don't want nothing to do with you guys. You guys were more educated than I was. You guys wore makeup. You guys wore nice clothes. You guys were just nice to women. Like, really? Is this how they're supposed to work? You know, the women that I knew, that if you were married, they slept with their husband, and they were all going out the same night together. Like, really? You know, it was really crazy. And after I did that 18-month program, something changed. I did something called service work. If you've never done service work, it's probably the main reason why I get to stay sober today. People did something called railroad. You know, they would take me places and volunteer me to do things. You know, and I did, you know, I was a secretary here for a year. I said, I got to go up to all these people and say, hello, how are you doing? And I got to be nice. You know, that's not my character. But that's my old ideals. You know, we come in here and we talk about our old ideals. What we were taught as a child. What we get to do today about our old ideals. You know, my parents both passed away about 6 years ago. My parents weren't married for 40-something years, and they died 2 months apart. My parents died right between my sobriety birthday. My dad died June 27th, and my mom died September 27th. And my sobriety date was September 24th. You know, and I'm really grateful that I got to be there for them, because I remember a lot of stuff from the past I wasn't there for. You know, I don't remember going. I remember leaving my kids at school, not being there for them, putting them in the bedroom, a lot of stuff. You know, I wasn't a mother because I wasn't taught those skills. You know, and I did the steps, and, you know, I think after you're here for a while, you can identify your character defects. You know, you can identify some behavior. I had some weird behavior. So I was about 10 years, 11 years sober. I didn't drink and I didn't do anything else, but I had some wild behavior. I used to talk to my sponsor about it, and I said, you know, I need to go to meetings and I need to hear something from other women. But you know what? I wasn't done with that behavior. And I used to ask God, you know, please let me know, you know, let me see something that I need to do. Well, I learned through my higher power that I needed validation from me, not from a person. Because as I was growing up, I always wanted validation from my dad, my brother, you know, is always the opposite sex. Then when I had like 8 years sober, I discovered that I didn't need that validation from anybody. And I needed it from my higher power. And you know, we were talking, when I first came in here, I didn't like people to hug me. So I tell people, you don't have to hug them. You can choose. You have a choice. You know, because these people, like, some women, like, they're running to you like, hell no, I don't want to hug you. You know, I don't want to hug you. I don't want to. And because I didn't have that. I didn't have that trust of hugging people. You know, a long time ago, you can't give something away if you don't have it. You know, and today I have love. I have empathy. I have compassion. I care about your feelings. And I realize that men have feelings. They're just not the same as our feelings. However, you know, we were sitting back there and, you know, I have a, my personality is kind of warped, you know. But I discovered that we all, you know, you look at each other, look at the next person. This is how I feel. We're all gifts in each other's lives. It may be a re-gift or it may just be a gift. I believe that, you know, I went to a training in Bakersfield and they said, no matter what goes on in your life, what situation, there's always a lesson in it. No matter what. You know, I got in trouble years ago where I work at. And I got to go back to my work. And I got a promotion. And I never thought I would make where I'm at today. You know, I have to be something called an ambassador for Chamber of Commerce. I have to be around people that are smarter than me, that are prettier than me, have more education than me. And I still feel like I'm out of place. But I just keep on coming back. You know, I just keep on going. You know, I just keep on going. You know, I was going through some stuff. And Susan says it was courage. You know, I lived in Porterville for, God, years, since I was 15. I haven't lived with anybody in 16 years. And me and Frank moved in with each other in September. I was scared to death, like, oh my God, I gotta, you know, how are you gonna live with somebody? You know, I'm used to my own space, and you know what? Doesn't need to be said. Doesn't need to be said by me, and doesn't need to be said by me right now. I keep my mouth shut a lot because that's what I was taught. Because my first action is, well, what the hell are you doing? You know. But today, you know what? I have my children in my life. I have a grandson that I got to be a part of my life. And when my parents died, I asked them a question. I told my dad, why didn't you ever love me? Like, I wanted you to love me. And he said that I was never taught that. So, you know, we come here and the old ideals change. And we get to learn new feelings, but they're not comfortable feelings. So today, you know, I tell my kids I love them no matter what. You know, I tell what I do for a living, it's positive reinforcement. Because, you know, I work with a lot of people with disabilities, and I have disabilities with reading. I hate reading. That's another resentment you got me up here. I hate reading in front of public because I stutter, I get nervous, but that's part of me getting better for me. You know, I look back years ago when I started this program, my life is, God, 720. It's like, I've done so many different levels, you know. I've overcome a few things because I got in trouble and I had a pass. I had to go through the Department of Social Services like 3 times to get cleared because I work in. I like to work now. I have a couple jobs, and you know, I've worked the steps. I have a sponsor, and I have this problem about connecting with people, just people. And I know what it is, but you know what? It gives me more things to work on. You know, I came up here, I was service here, I was a waitress for 8 years here. I had knee surgery in November of last year, and so I had to stop. And I hit a downfall then where I was scared. Something scared the shit out of me. And I'm thinking, you know what? I believe that things happen in your life to make you feel better. And, you know, we always read the short version of the Serenity Prayer, but I really like the long version. You know, hardships are a pathway to peace. Take in this world as I will have it, trusting that He will make all things right if I surrender to His will, so I may be reasonably happy in this life and supremely happy in the next. So I really applied that when I got this new job. I said, lead me where you need me, God. Lead me where you need me. Lead me where you need me. You know, I got the job, and it's like the program. Stay here for a year. If you don't like it, go back to your old stuff. Well, it's been a year. I like it 51%. So I'm not comfortable because I was thinking if I was comfortable in my recovery, a lot of us get complacent, comfortable, and we stop going to meetings. We stop, you know, we stay sober, but we don't, our behavior changes. You know, I need to be around people that want the same thing out of life than I do. And I believe, you know, I work with a lot of dominating women, and I can work the program in their lives and they don't even know it. It's kind of weird. You know, my boss came up and it was Mother's Day. She gave us all flowers in our meeting. And so we went and gave her a card and some flowers. And she was talking about healthy boundaries. And she goes, Aneta, see, I learned that from you, you know, healthy boundaries, because I'm learning to have healthy boundaries. But I'm learning to be nice to me. And it's really me. I can be nice to you, but my head will, you know, say negative things to me. Negative, you know, you're not worth it. You don't need to have that job. You don't need to do this. You don't belong with all those other people. And I just keep on coming back. You know, you just keep on coming back because, you know, there's a time in my life that I have a really, really good life. And I get to be part of other people's lives. And I never had that part of other people's lives, you know. But today, you know, I just want to wish everybody happy Mother's Day, all the fathers, you know. I have two children. My parents are both dead. We don't have a lot of family. And sometimes, you know, my ex-husband was an alcoholic. He died when he was 42 years old. And then I became an alcoholic, you know, after he died. And I'm wondering, why do I get this gift of recovery? You know, because I work my ass off. You know, I don't drink for today. I don't do anything else. I do get road rage down five, you know, I just moved to Exeter, and those people don't move very fast at 6:30, 7 o'clock in the morning going to work. And then I got to, you know, doing the steps are pretty simple, but then you got to apply them in your life. You got to be kind. You got to be respectful. You got to go to work on time. You can't misuse company time. You know, me and Frank, we got to go I've never been on a business trip. Like, oh my God, they're spending all this money on me. Why the hell? I'll never go again. I went to Oakland. I went to 11th and Broadway in Oakland. I was scared to death. I didn't go out at night. Frank said, no, you don't have any street smart. And I said, thank God. Maybe that's one thing that God took me away from me, because years ago, I was out all night, you know. But today, you know what? I think the best thing that people can do in this program is be there for each other. And the simplest word is thank you. And you know, you can say thank you for being in my life, and they go, why? They always want to know why. But just say thank you to people and see how many people respond. But, you know, I believe that God lead me up here, you know. And I'm grateful now. At the beginning, you know, I was like pissed off at her, like, what the hell? You know, I'm going to pay you back for something. And today, you know what? If I think about it, I don't really think with my head. I have to speak from my heart. Because a lot of us, Tom used to tell me, Aneta, you have uncommon sense. Like, what does that mean? You have it and you don't know it. And I believe that. And he used to, you know, I miss him. He used to say, Aneta, we have everything in us already. We're perfect children of God. We just need other people in our lives to pull it out, to teach us about serenity, to teach us to do the steps, to, you know, just a lot of different things. And today, you know, even people are putting your life to get you angry, you know, to teach you patience, you know, a lot of different things. And if you're new in the program, or if you're just going through something new, a new feeling, because why I stay here, because I'm still that immature feelings. I don't understand my feelings sometimes, because I can say, well, I can identify this feeling, but my head tells me it's a different feeling. Because there's only one feeling I knew in here was anger. And anger was fear. And I fear a lot of stuff. And I'm just grateful. You know, I just keep on coming back. And thank you. That's all. My name's Vanetta. Okay. I'm going to introduce the main speaker. Her name is Sherry B. from San Fernando. Come up here. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Sherry Brown, and I'm an alcoholic. Happy Mother's Day. I don't want to forget that. Happy Mother's Day. Welcome to the new people. Welcome to all of you who are new to Alcoholics Anonymous. And before I forget, I'd like to thank you for having me. Susan, thank you. Thank you, Carol. Thank you for having me for dinner last night. I met with several of you. Doug, who was a historical, it was a walk down history, really. Yes, I enjoyed that. And Jose, really enjoyed talking with you. And Anita, thank you for that talk. Thank you very much. Julie, thank you. Before I forget, I'd like to start with where I am today. That sort of centers me. Thanks for the water. Thank you. And the breakfast. Very nice group. I'd like to say that if this is the last talk I ever give, I know one will be, I want you to know that I love this group. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. And I feel very blessed to be asked to be here today. I think it's a privilege to be asked to share in Alcoholics Anonymous. I enjoyed our 10-minute speaker very much. Today, I got up this morning, and thank you for the nice room. Thank you for having me there. And I thought to myself how many nights I spent in motel rooms and many nights I spent in hotel rooms. And way back then, and my story will come together, I promise you. It will. No matter where I start, I think it'll come together with some identification here. I hope you can identify with some of the feelings. So I was thinking about the TV. I was trying to get that to go off direct, and I just to hear the news. I don't know why, like it was going to be uplifting or something this morning. But I couldn't get that off, and I thought to myself, well, this is a lot more complicated than when you used to put coins in the TV to keep it going. This is where I grew up. Literally, you had to put coins in the TV. If a guy wants my heart, it's not jewels that I want. It's not travel. It's a TV that you have to put coins in. That's what I've been looking for. Anyway, to give you a little bit of background where I come from, I don't believe it's the reason I'm here in Alcoholics Anonymous. It could be. But I came from an alcoholic background. My dad was an alcoholic. My dad had a bottle of Old Crow on the table. For those of you who are new, that's Rotgut whiskey. And he had a bottle of Coca-Cola, literally a bottle of Coca-Cola. They're bringing them back now. It's all retro, but bottle of Coca-Cola. And he would call that his medicine. And surely I know today it was. It was, because I needed that. I swore I'd never take a drink of alcohol, although I absolutely adored my father. He was tall, dark, and handsome, and I just adored him. And he seemed to have the answers for everything. I know today an alcoholic has the answers for everything, right? You ask him a question, and we'll give you an answer. We will. I'm often wrong, but what do they say? Seldom in doubt. That's me. So he would call this his medicine, and I would see my dad go to jail. I'd see him being taken off, rather, in the patrol car, and I'd try and run after him. This was after they had an argument or the neighbors called the police or whatever. My dad would go to jail for one night, and we'd leave town because my dad was a gambler also. And we just followed the racetracks around the country, literally around the racetrack, around the country. This past Saturday was the Kentucky Derby. And I went over to Santa Anita because that was home to me, and because that brought back the feel. I just do it every year I go. My dad's been gone now for a long time. And if I fail to tell you, he was sober 23 years when he passed. It wasn't that I followed him into Alcoholics Anonymous, because he went to one meeting, said he couldn't believe the things that these people talked about, made him want to go out and drink. He said, in fact, I did go out and drink, and I haven't had a drink since. That's not my story, folks. Not my story. But we roamed around the country, and just to give you an idea, I don't mean that we... And so driving up here, rather, brought back a lot of memories, because we were always on the open road, and I don't mean that we just moved from one state to the other. I have siblings, 4 brothers and 4 sisters. And we were all born, except for 2, in a different state. I was born in Galveston, Texas. My brother was born in Colorado, West Virginia, Phoenix. We just roamed around. And my mother was Catholic. I always say my dad just went along for the ride, you know. But he swore he'd raise us Catholic, and he did. We all went to Catholic school. My mother was an Al-Anon, certainly, without having any program. Every time my dad would go to jail, my mother would ask why he continued to drink when he saw what it did, that they would get into fights, that the police would come and whatever. And I remember this look on my father's face. And the look was one of confusion. I remember as a small child looking at him. He didn't know the answer to that. He could no more have said that alcohol changes everything for me. He without changing a thing. He couldn't have said that once I take a drink, the drink takes me, and I need to continue drinking. I have an allergy of the body. That the mental obsession is that a drink will make anything better. That I have this emptiness inside, that alcohol is the only thing that will fill up. He couldn't have said any of that. I couldn't have said any of that. And what he did say was, if you had all these kids to feed, you'd drink too. That's what he said. So we roamed around the country, and I don't think my dad ever went back for a second appearance in court. I know he never did any jail time. He would just leave town. We would leave town in the middle of the night. We would leave. I'm just painting a picture for you, not because when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I had a lot of self-pity going, not because of I want to elicit your sympathy. I just want to tell you where I came from. When I got engaged one time, the fellow said to me, he said, this is where I come from. I live home in Michigan. I've lived here all my life. He was drawing a picture of his home and the tree in the backyard that they had a swing on and whatever. He said, where'd you come from? And I drew a Motel 6 and a highway because that was the way I lived. We would leave town in the middle of the night. There were big fancy chandeliers and hotel rooms, and we would be sneaking out the side door. Or we would be living in little motels, and we would go to school, and we would give your address, and we would be there for months of time, and then we would leave town. I never missed a grade, though. None of us ever missed a grade. I don't know if they just passed us because, or certainly we passed. But we would go to a new school, and we'd have to say our name and where we came from, and I always felt different. I always felt different. I never felt comfortable in my own skin. And I think I've heard that before in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've heard it a lot. I don't know if it's part of the disease. I just know that that's how I felt. So when my dad would come home from the racetrack, occasionally he would work at a construction job or something. He later founded a paving company and helped build Phoenix. So he did settle down. I'd like to say that. But I don't know what it was, but when he came in, I know today what it was. I didn't know then. Restless, irritable, and discontent. He would pour a couple of drinks from that bottle of Old Crow, mix it with Coca-Cola, and then he would start singing Danny Boy. And then he would start passing out coins, and everything was wonderful. And I remember that Danny Boy moment. I needed that, because I was so ill at ease and uncomfortable in my own skin. They left town when I was 16. They left Glendale, California, and I was sitting on the... My dad had left ahead of time. I was sitting on the bus stop on Brand Boulevard, and my mother pulled away, and I stayed, and my brother stayed. I was 16 years of age, hadn't had a drink of alcohol. I was the one that was do good, be good. I didn't know where all those kids were coming from. I didn't want to catch that. And, yeah. And I remember, by the way, you know, it's kind of ironic I'm speaking on Mother's Day because my kids informed me years ago, I have two sons, that this is just another day. So I don't know anything about celebrating a joyous Mother's Day with your children, but I do know about how to live sober and have a great day anyway in the midst of being neglected. I understand that. So if you understand that, okay. They left town and I stayed there in Glendale. I had 2 weeks left in that house. My brother stayed. He went home after 3 weeks. I never went home. I felt free. I felt like I didn't have to worry about taking care of kids. And I'll tell you how that went when I was growing up. We used to eat in these truck stops. They were the best. They had the best food. I don't know if they do today, but they had the best food. And we would go in, and my mother would announce the coming event this way. She would say, Phil, they'll be my father. I think I'm that way again. And I thought, oh, Holy Mother of God, you know, there's five or six of, I mean, we can barely fit, you know, in the car. And I didn't know anything about smelling the food or morning sickness, and that's what was happening to her. And I thought, it has to do with the menu, so as she ordered, I ordered from the opposite because I didn't want to catch it. I was so confused. We did not talk about anything when I was growing up. I went to Catholic school, and when we got to Thou Shalt Not Commit Adultery, I knew it had something to do with something because they would hush-hush, and they said, the nun said, I want all of the boys to leave the classroom. And I thought, well, good, now I'm going to find out so I don't catch this, right? And I was tired of taking care of kids. And she said, don't ever sit on a boy's lap. Bring the boys back in. And that was the extent of my sex education. That was it. So I lived in confusion. I got lonesome for the agony about 6 months after they left. They went up to Stockton. Someone mentioned Stockton. They went up to Stockton, California. They went back east, and then they ended up in Stockton, California. But I was down in L.A., going to high school, working at a cleaner's, babysitting. Knew how to do that. Hadn't had a drink of alcohol. And I took the bus and went up for Christmas. And I had this fantasy that things were going to be different. And the police came, the same thing happened, and I came back down with that feeling of, why me, God? I was never grateful. Why me? And what happened was, I said to this girlfriend in this apartment, I said, let's get a bottle and celebrate New Year's Eve. It was New Year's Day. New Year's Eve, rather. And she said, when my parents have company, they make screwdrivers. They get orange juice and vodka, and they make screwdrivers. So we went to Zodi's department store in Burbank. It'd be like Kmart or Target. And we stood outside until one of you went in and took our money and bought us a bottle. And we came home, and when Kay mixed those drinks for herself and for me, it didn't change anything for her. But it was magic for me. It was absolute magic. I wanted to call up my mother and tell her why my father drank. Because it changes everything. It made me feel confident, and I had never been out on a date or anything, but I continued to drink, and I said, Kay, why don't you have another one? And she said, Sherry, I'm beginning to feel this one. I know that's the litany of the non-alcoholic. I know that today. I think ours is, I've had a couple, you know. But anyway, I continued to drink, and I was so confident then, I called up the Catholic priest. And yes, he was tall, dark, handsome, and had an Irish brogue. And I told him how good-looking he was. Yeah, I did. And I invited him to come on over and celebrate New Year's Eve. Yes. I'd never been out on a date, I want you to know. But alcohol did something for me. And I told him how the other priest in the parish wasn't nearly as good-looking as he was. And I found out later that he was on the extension. And they were both just listening to this. And the priest did come over. I see him all the time now. He's Monsignor. And he's not tall, dark, and handsome, you know, but he's...
He was.
And he came over that night, and he walked me up and down for about 3.5 hours until I got rid of what he called that cheap alcohol that could have killed me. Because she told him I had consumed that bottle. By the time I got off that phone, I was just staring straight ahead. And in the church, and like New Year's Day fell on Sunday, I think, this last year, like it did then. And we were in church. And this priest talked about the decline of the youth in our society today, many years ago. And I'll tell you something. I thought if my mother could see this, if my mother knew this, she'd be mortified. I mean, I just couldn't imagine what I'd done. And yet, on the other hand, I couldn't wait to do it again. I could not wait to drink. I found magic. And I continued to drink out there for the next 9 or 10 years. I drank in those bars. I had the best music. I say this today. I think we had the best music. I had the Beatles and the Stones and Elvis and the Doors. And I was just happy. I was drinking down there on Sunset. And I have to clarify, because I wasn't walking the street. I was in the clubs, you know. I've had many people come up to me after I've said something like that and identify with me, you know. So, but I drank out there, and I met him. I met him. And he certainly knew, I mean, within a couple of days that he loved me, you know, of course. And I was looking for that. I was looking for some way to fix me. And he said, let's get married. And I said, oh, yes. And I ended up pregnant, and he left town. I was 4.5 months pregnant now. And I was told to give the baby up. Everyone wanted me to give the baby up. This priest that I knew, my friends, because they just saw this kid that was out there drinking and carrying on. And I kept him. I wanted to keep him. I wanted to give him everything that I hadn't had. I wanted to give him stability. I pictured being the Den Scout mother and the Cub Scout and whatever and baseball. I wanted to do all of that. And what happened was alcohol had taken a hold of me to where I was a periodic drunk. I couldn't predict my behavior once I started drinking. And I'll describe it to you. I would take him to the park. And I would put down the toys, and I'd put down the ball, I'd put down the lunch I made, and I had this massive headache or hangover. And I would say, hurry up and play. Now, I'd look around, and I'd see you mothers with your child in the sand, and you were playing, and I would feel such guilt that I just couldn't wait to go drink. Because I felt this guilt and remorse, and I thought, why can't I like this? I love him. And I knew how to go to work and support him and take care of him. But I had this obsession with alcohol. Now, many years later, I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I want to describe to you one of the best days of my life. My son said to me, I'm going to take you out to lunch for Mother's Day. Happy Mother's Day. And he said, I know it's no big deal you eating in a restaurant because you travel all the time with your work, which I was at the time. He said, and I know it's no big deal you're eating in a restaurant because you can't cook and you eat out here on restaurants. I said, so where are we going? And he said, you'll see, Mom. And he drove up to the park. And I said, what are we doing here? And he said, Mom, you'll see. And he got out a blanket. And he put a ghetto blaster, but it had My Fair Lady playing. And he put a vase of flowers, and he put all these favorite things I like to eat. And he said, Mom, I've heard your story. He said, I know you did a poor job of this when I was growing up, but today we'll get it right. And it still is, I mean, he doesn't talk to me today, but it's still there in my heart, you know. I feel like I've walked on water with him and I've been on the cross. Right now I'm on the cross, but I know that's subject to change. I know that. But the truth of the matter is, when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't want children because I'd been taking care of them my whole life. And I didn't want Alcoholics Anonymous when I was introduced to it. And yet the two things that I had the greatest joy, the greatest memories, the greatest love for, my children and Alcoholics Anonymous. Without a doubt. I drank out there until I got stopped by the police coming out of a club one night because left to my own devices. They had a sign that said no left turn after 2 a.m. And I thought, it doesn't apply to me. You know, nobody's going to be back there at 2 a.m. And I got stopped. I got pulled over for turning left illegally. And as I rolled down that window, the policeman said to me, have you had anything to drink? And I said, I had a couple. I've been in there all night drinking. My girlfriend was passed out on the front seat. As soon as that air hit, she's passed out, my roommate. So he made me get out there, and he said to me, he said, I'm going to give you a test. He said, if you pass it, I'm just going to give you a test for turning left illegally. He said, if you don't pass it, I'm going to take you in and book you for drunk driving. And all that could go through my head was, I don't have anybody to bail me out of jail. How am I going to get, I'm out by myself. All this flashed through. It sobers you up right away, you know, when you see those lights. So he gave me a test, and I'm stumbling. I swear to you, I stumbled. I got back. I kept going, though, and I got back in the car. And he came, and he said, if I give you a ticket for turning left illegally and you crack up on the way home, it's just going to be my badge for not booking you. He said, so go have some coffee. And he said, what's wrong with her? And she passed out. I said, she's tired. And he said, he said, get her some coffee, too. So that was the extent of my involvement with the law at that point in my life. I had never been arrested. I had never been stopped. God knows there's not enough meetings in Alcoholics Anonymous to express the gratitude that I have for the way God took care of me, because I aimed that car, that ton of metal out there at unsuspecting people because I drove drinking. And I didn't drive drinking that many times, but it only takes once. It only takes once. And God spared me. Why he spared me? I guess there's a job that I still need to do. I went through and I married a man who, they told me this. They said, give him a chance. Put him up for adoption and give him a chance to have a family life, a home, a father who will love him. And I said, well, just pray for a father who loves him. And I prayed for a man who, I asked God to give me a man who would accept him as his own and love him as his own without unconditionally and adopt him as his son. And you know, I got exactly what I prayed for. I got a man who absolutely adored my son from the very beginning. He was three when they met. He adored him. He adopted him. He's to this day, they're as close as can be. Now, we got divorced shortly after. I didn't pray for a husband who loved me, but I prayed for a man who would love my son. Newcomers, you need to be very specific. Very. It's true. Honest to God. I got exactly what I prayed for. Truly. I continued to drink I met this man I told you about, and we had another child. That other son is one of us today. He's been in Alcoholics Anonymous. He had a year at one point. He had another year, and now he's been out there for about 12, 15 years. He drinks. And so I always, at the Our Father, I always, day and night, I remember my son. And I know this, that when I see a newcomer walk through the doors, when I sit there with someone who's, you know, a couple of years sober, whatever, like Jose, what I think of is, this could be my son. That someday my son, hopefully, will walk through those doors. And maybe I'll be here for him, maybe I won't, but you'll be here. If I'm here for you, you'll be here for him. Because I see a father walk through the doors when I see a newcomer. I see someone's son, someone's daughter, someone's husband, someone's niece that they're praying for. And my job is to say, welcome. Would you like a red jelly donut? Because that's my group, the Red Jelly Donut Group. Alcoholics Anonymous, down in Tarzana. To say, here, have a cup of coffee. We don't care where you've been. We don't care what you've done. We don't care whether you have a nickel in your pocket or you don't. We don't care if you're wealthy. Sit down. We know where you've been inside. So I continue to drink, and I married this man, and he wore a three-piece suit to work, and magna cum laude graduate, and I thought my life would be different because that from the outside, things looked better. But nothing changed from the inside, and he became almost a daily drinker, crashing cars, and I saw the handwriting on the wall, and I called up Father Terry, who I've known since I was a kid, and he's in the program. And I told him about his drinking. So he sent a woman from Al-Anon to me. And I ended up at a few meetings about Al-Anon. And somewhere along the line, I heard, one drink is too many and 1,000 not enough. Somewhere along the line, I heard a woman talking, but trying to talk about her husband, and they said, no, we look at ourselves here. But I heard this conversation going on, and this woman said to this other woman, she said, don't create guilt for him. He already has more than you'll ever know. And I identified with that. I was full of guilt and remorse. And finally, I kept saying to this woman who picked me up, I said, you know, I identify with this, I identify with that. She only knew about the drunk who was drinking all the time like her husband had been before he got sober 6 years ago. She didn't know about the periodic drinker, apparently. But she sent me over to Radford in North Hollywood. She said George's sponsor, George being her husband, his sponsor, Bobby Earl, was speaking. And Bobby Earl said these words. He said, I could never go any place without a drink and feel comfortable in my own skin. I thought, oh, did they plant him here? He said, I would have traded places with anyone because I didn't like who I was. And that was me. I used to fantasize about who I could be. And he said, I was suicidal my whole life. Contemplated suicide. And that was me. From a small child, I contemplated suicide. He said, I haven't had a drink now in 12 years. He said, I can go any place on the face of the earth without a drink, and I'm comfortable in my own skin. He said, I wouldn't trade places with any of you. I don't care what you have. He said, because I'm beginning to like the fellow I'm becoming. And he said, suicide. He said, there's not enough time to do all the things I want to do. He said, I love living. And I thought, my God, what would that feel like? And he said, if you want what we have, just don't take a drink and come back. Get that book. He said, read it and come back. And I've been coming back ever since. He gave me the message at my very first meeting. And I came back and, you know, they put me up front and they told me that I should start washing the ashtrays. And I said, I don't smoke, because I used to smoke. It's so thick you could cut it. And they said, we don't care. And then they said I should wash the cups because we didn't have styrofoam. And I said, I don't drink the coffee. I didn't. I caught that in Alcoholics Anonymous, I want you to know. And they say you just wash the cups and you help set up. So I'm coming to meetings and I'm feeling maudlin, and they knew I used to hit my head I had a bruise right here, this side, as I got up because I'd hit the wall. I really would hit the door jamb because I never looked up. And this fellow said to me one time, I didn't think they paid any attention. I was hoping they didn't pay any attention. And he said, Sherry, I thought, well, he knows my name. I don't know how. But he said, Sherry, if you look up, you don't ever have to hit that door jamb again. I thought, oh, I just hate you, but thank you. Because now I'm embarrassed, right? Of course it's your fault. So one day I come to a meeting and I've got a bandage on this wrist and I've got a bandage over here. And they knew how depressed I was. I suffered severe depression. And they said, what happened? I said, I knew what they were thinking. I said, oh, no. I said, I just ironed this blouse to come to a meeting. And they said, would you care to elaborate? And now they're gathered around. They want to know how that happened. And I said, I ironed this blouse to come to a meeting. I said, I put it on, and I saw I forgot to iron the cuffs. So I ironed the cuffs. And the alcoholic always takes the same action, thinking you're going to get different results. I ironed the other one. And they just shook their head, and they did. You know, the newcomer is such a world of entertainment, you know. Really, truly. We've all been there. So they tried to put me up front and I'd end up in the back. But I just kept coming and I had this reservation. I didn't drink that way. I didn't do that. That would come in. And what happened was I was 9 months sober and I had a sponsor. But I was planning a drunk. And I tell you this for the new people. I was planning a drunk. And there was down at the end of Radford, 4343 Radford, down at the end of the block, you had to walk past this place of condominium they were building. And they were putting in a brick walk driveway, which was unusual. And I remember they said, put the drink off. So I said, all right, to myself, when the last brick is in place, I'll keep going to your meetings, but when the last brick is in place, I'm drinking. And I pictured Johnny Walker. I pictured my wild turkey. I mean, so I was feeling a little better, but I was still planning this drunk. And one day as I'm planning this, a man said something in a meeting. I swear to you, I couldn't tell you what it was today if you put $1 million on the table. But I went up to him, which is something I never did. And I said, would you tell me about this? And he said, oh, wait a minute. And it was like E.F. Hutton was talking, you know, because people were gathering. And I thought, now I'm embarrassed. I hate you. And I wanted to leave, but something kept me there because I just didn't want to feel the way I felt anymore. And somehow, I guess I didn't really want to drink, even though I was planning it. And he said, I see you sit, and now he's pointing too. I love that one. I see you sitting back there in the back of the room. He said, you never talk to a soul. He said, if you want this, you have to give it away to keep it. You have to start welcoming those new people. And he said, you need to get, well, he told me that I needed him. You know, I won't tell you the way he said it, but he said, and I needed him, and he put his arms around me. And I said, fine. And I thought I'd take one of those suggestions. And I decided the next day I came to the meeting, still planning the drunk, walking. It seemed like a long driveway. If you go over there now, it's a very short driveway, but it seemed like forever. So I went up to a woman. I didn't look up that much, so I didn't see hands go up, but this woman looked miserable. She looked like I felt. And I said, hi, I'm Sherry Brown. Are you new? And she just looked at my hand and she didn't touch it. And she said, no, honey, are you? I thought, I just hate you. But it's okay to think it as long as I don't say it, right? And I said, yes, I guess I am. And I felt like I was just slithering off. And I found that man sitting outside with another one of these old timers. And I related what I just told you. Angry. I said, if that's taking it and giving it away, you can take it and shove it. I don't want any part of it. Exactly what I said. I'm not proud of it, but that's what I said. And they just roared. That was the funniest thing they ever heard. They just laughed. And I thought, what's so funny? And the guy said to me, he said, honey, he said, you keep doing it because you do it for you. And I never forgot that. The switch flipped. And I just kept doing it and putting out my hand then and thinking it didn't matter what happened, that that was the secret. And that is the secret, I want you to know. I've been doing that ever since. I tell people today, I don't even have an iron in my place because I can't trust myself. But today, I've been sober since October 1st, 1975, and I dry clean. It's a lot safer for someone like me. Thank you. Thank you. So for a little over 41 years now, I've been walking this path sober from day one. Haven't found it necessary to go back out there because of the scouts, the people we used to call scouts that would go out. And they'd come back with arrows and they'd tell us there's nothing out there. They're still out there. And the feelings have never driven me out of Alcoholics Anonymous. People talk about relationships. I know nothing about relationships. I know this. That if you looked at me and you talked about me and I talk about me, we're relating. You know, that was my idea of a relationship when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. I know this today. I know that when people talk about going out on a relationship, I said this a long time ago. I listened to them when they said don't get involved that first year. But believe me, I said if anybody's going out in a relationship, it's not going to be me. You know, not going to be me. I know this today. I know that my sobriety is not dependent on any one condition in my life. It cannot be. It cannot be dependent on whether or not I have him or I have the job or I have the kids loving me and doting. It cannot depend on having the car or not having the car. It can't depend on anything. It has got to be significant, sobriety in and of itself. And I made that decision, that determination, many years ago. In fact, I'm one of the ones who asked my sponsor when I was 5 years sober. And I had seen enough of the passing parade by then. I asked her this question. I said, how, in exactly this way, I said, how do I be one who's here for the long haul? I said, I know it's a day at a time, but how do I be one who's here for the long haul? And she said these words. She said, Sherry, she said, the alcoholic will drink again who does not want to be responsible. She said, if you're an alcoholic like I am, your first responsibility is to yourself. You don't take a drink no matter what. And then she said, you work those steps to try and be a little bit better today than you were the day before. It's what Norm used to say, Norm Alby. She said, and try and help the other alcoholic walking through those doors. You meet your responsibilities on a daily basis. You have kids, you feed them, you go to work, you take care of your responsibilities. And that's as simple as I've been keeping it over these years. There's no magic to staying sober if you know the difference between alcohol and water. That's what they told me when I came in. You know, I hear people, I was a psych major and I had all the books and I read all the literature and I had tons of books on how to be your own best friend. And you know, today I don't take my emotional temperature. Today I just go about doing what I think God would have me do on a daily basis. Now, it says in the book that unless I enlarge and perfect my spiritual life, I will not survive the certain trials, and in my case that's literal, and low spots ahead. And I'll tell you why that's literal. I've had a lot of adversity in my life over the years. I suffered severe depression for almost the first... I suffered severe depression for years, and it wasn't until I was 10 years sober that the depression really lifted. And I remember living in that from the time I was young. All I did was not drink and go to meetings. And I said to my sponsor, I'm trying to share some things with the new people that you might use someday, might remember. What I said to her were these words. I said, what difference does it make? The only time I feel good is when I'm in a meeting anyway. And she said, then go to more meetings. That was the answer for everything. Be of service, that we're takers, and we have to learn how to give. That, I tried marriage. I decided one of my sons took off at that point and wasn't around the family at all. And I was going through just guilt and remorse, missing him, whatever, you know. And I decided marriage was the answer. I mean, it certainly should be the answer for something, shouldn't it? I think. Anyway, I tried that, but that got that annulled. God bless him. But then I decided to try it again, and I cooked dinner, and I thought, well, I'm trying to do everything right, so I cooked, and it was about 6:15, and I said, dinner will be ready at 6:30. He said, in my house, we always eat dinner at 6 o'clock. I told him, well, then go home, you know. I knew that wasn't going anyplace, you know. It didn't. It did not. So when I have new women, babies, whatever, come up and ask me, you know, about their relationships, I tell them, oh, honey, you know, I know how to stay sober. That's about it. I know how to stay sober. You know, if I don't go to meetings all the time. If I don't go to meetings, what happens is I become irritable, restless, irritable. I've never stayed away for a few days, but I'll tell you, I get like this. You drink that coffee, can't you just rinse out your cup? I mean, is the female anatomy connected to the kitchen sink? I mean, things like that come to mind, you know? So you read the paper and you've got it spread all over. Do you think you could just pick it up? And I live alone. So meetings keep me centered. I was a teacher. I substituted most of the time. And I went to college. I'd always wanted to go to college, so I had started college the month before I got sober. And I wanted to quit. And they told me in Alcoholics Anonymous, take the principles you've learned here and take them out there. You just don't quit college today. So I didn't quit college today, and I graduated 4 years later. Because of Alcoholics Anonymous, I wanted a good job. I pictured a corporate job someplace. And this fellow in Alcoholics Anonymous, remember, we always have the answer. He said, come down and work at my company. They're hiring. And I said, well, who do you work for? And he said, Frito-Lay. And I thought, well, I pictured a great job with Frito-Lay. And they gave me my very own truck, you know, after 4 years. Yes, they did. I had gone through 4 years of going to meetings, no less than 5 to 7 meetings. I was working 38 hours a week. I had 2 children, raising them on my own. And I was taking no less than 17 to 20 units, and I graduated in 4 years. And they gave me my very own truck, you know. And I would get up at 4:30 in the morning, hating that man and everything about it. And I was resentful. And they give you your truck to take home, this great big, I'd never driven anything over a Volkswagen at that time. So I hit a U-Haul. Anyway, another story. But they gave you your very own truck to take home at night to straighten up your bag of Fritos and whatever. Yes. So do my makeup and get on my truck. Yes. Because vanity, right? So my kids would love that. They would get on the, I'd park it in the neighborhood there right in front of the house, and the kids would come and help me straighten up the bags of Fritos. They just loved it. And the neighborhood kids would come, and they loved it too. So one day I hear the neighborhood kids talking to their mother, and the one child says to his mother, do you know, he said, our dad just goes to work in an office. He was an attorney. And he said, you know, Stephen and Donovan's mother has her very own truck. You know? And I thought, oh, yes, I do. That's right. And my attitude changed, and I realized I got to be grateful for where I am, for what I have. I have to be grateful right here in the now. I've learned this since I've been sober. I stay in the now. I find something good about any situation, and I keep my mouth shut, and then I'm safe. I'm safe. If you just do those 3 things, newcomer, you got it made, really, because you're not going to drink in the now, I don't think. So what happened was I kept getting better jobs. I got another job with an insurance company. I started an agency. I audited hospital bills. That went great until the HMOs and PPOs came in, and anyway, so I had to, then I went to teaching, and what happened was I'd always wanted to work in the film industry, and what happened, it just came about. And I ended up with this independent studio, and I went to work for them, and I worked for them for 3.5 years, and I had a great time. And then I got a call from someone in the program who said, come over to this studio, we're going to do an animated film. And come and work for us. He's a 5-time Emmy Award winning producer. And I went over there and I went to work and I was having a great time. I love my life. I got in my home and I just said to God one morning, I just love my life. It took me a long time to get where I'm at, but I love my life. And what happened was, after being there for 3.5 years, it came to light that the principals of the company had taken the funds that the investors had invested. And the FBI decided that they were going to round up everyone, several of us, top performing people. I never lied to anybody. I didn't have any knowledge of this. And what happened was they indicted. And at 39 years sober, I was facing 20 years in a federal penitentiary. 20 years. Now, that's quite a stretch from getting a traffic ticket, I want you to know. I thought about suicide. I thought about, I want you to know that. I just couldn't believe where I was. I was standing in front of a 92-year-old judge that didn't care about anything, that cared only about the fact that the federal prosecutor wanted a conviction and he was going to give it to him. And that's exactly what happened. And the people in Alcoholics Anonymous wrote letters and they told them they'd known me for almost 40 years. They didn't care what had happened in that courtroom. It could not be true, and it wasn't true that they had known me. It wasn't. But the fact of the matter is, I stood before that judge, and the night before, it wasn't a matter of was I going to kill myself. It was how. Because I just couldn't imagine being locked up for something I didn't do. I never had anything. I had a traffic ticket 20-some years ago. So I stood before that judge because I knew I had to trust in this God. I couldn't say that I trusted in God. I couldn't have been talking to people in Alcoholics Anonymous over the years and telling them that I had a loving God that I believed in, who always, during the darkest days and the longest nights, had my back and not go and do what I needed to do. So I stood before that judge, you had all written letters. And I had to write a letter, I was told, and usually you ask for leniency, whatever. My attorney said, in this case, when you're not guilty, you just write a letter to him. And I wrote a letter, and I said, if you read these letters, and you've seen what my life has been like for nearly four decades now, you'd know that I'm not capable of living this duplicitous life of crime. That this is who I am, and you must have some sense of people after sitting on the bench all these years. I said, do what you want with me, because the government wanted me to go to work for them, wear a wire and plead to this and take 5 years in prison. I told them I wouldn't take 5 months, that I would not say I was doing something that I wasn't doing, that I was not living the life that I had presented and that I had been responsible for almost 40 years. Do what you want with me. And that judge, through those principals in prison, they're in prison now, and he gave me 3,000 hours of community service and probation. So I got my own probation officer, and I had to drug test 3 times. That's an experience. My hat's off to you for those who have gone through that. It's an experience. I have to ask permission to go out of the area. I cannot put money in your basket. When the basket goes around, because they took $22 million, and I have to be responsible because they said you're in a conspiracy. I said, conspiracy? I'm incapable of forming a partnership with another human being. You don't know me. And they want me to pay $2.56 million at $30 a month, and I'm ordered not to put money in my church basket or in Alcoholics Anonymous because if I have a dime extra, they want it. The government wants it. So I'm sorry about that. I didn't put money in your basket. I had to ask permission to come up here. Travel request, and I forgot it was out of the area when I accepted, when I was first contacted. I just accepted. And then a few weeks ago, I realized, oh my God, this is out of the area, the Central District. So I had to put in a travel request. So this is what I got back. They said, we've transferred your case to L.A. You have a new probation officer, who I'd never met. And we want to know, are you traveling with any fellow felons? Are you going to be around any fellow felons? Only at dinner. Yep. Yes, sir. And are any of them ones that were involved in your case? Oh, yes, they get out of prison to travel with me to AA. That's so I was panicked because until Monday, I hadn't gotten the okay, and I didn't think there was any problem, or I'd have contacted you, but I was really on pins and needles, and they finally gave me my okay to come up here and talk to you. With the stipulation that I have to call within 24 hours because it's a felon leaving your county and going back into my own. So I will do that. It's a new world for me, folks. It's a brand new world, but I'll tell you something. I'd like to thank you for asking me to speak because I was told when I go to a meeting, it doesn't count for community service. I've done 1,700 hours now of community service. I'm in the appeals process, which isn't fun. But when I speak at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, I get community service hours. So thank you. I appreciate that. That's right. Appreciate Carol giving you my name. There aren't words to tell you what this did to me. Emotionally, there aren't words. To just take your life and put it over here in this other world. But I want you to know something. I have a trust in God today that I didn't have. A trust, a belief that as I'm... You know, the foundation goes deep if the building's rising high, and I believe that God has blessed me. And I believe that my faith has never been stronger, that I turn to Him. I'll tell you what my community service consists of, in case you're wondering. The priests all came together, and they said, we don't want her out there on the highway. We want her in church here. So I pick up after Mass. I set up for baptisms. That's what I do for community service. And I speak at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I tell you this, if there's anything I can tell you, is that you never know what's going to come. Norm Albee used to say, you never know what's coming down the pike. We don't know what's coming, but I know without a doubt that my primary purpose is to stay sober. My primary purpose is to reach out my hand to the next guy walking in this meeting and to say, welcome. Welcome. I know how you feel, that there's always someone going through something that's greater than you are, that if God gave me the gift of sobriety, for over four decades now, He's given me the willingness to be here, to share with you, to tell you this, that there is a loving God, that if you don't have one, borrow mine. Thank you for having me.